coming to you from the HagmanReport.com studio. Located in the Keystone State, birthplace of a mighty nation, it's your host, Doug Hagman.
And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this edition of the Hagman Report. Got to get my act together here, right? It is Monday, May 20th, 2024. I am so pleased to have with me a very special guest, Jack Cashel, who is one of the most intelligent, most thorough investigative, independent investigative researcher, journalist. I would call him an investigator, period, because he gets to the meat of things. You know, with all of the headlines, just real quick, you got a helicopter crash taking out the president of Iran, the butcher of Tehran, and his foreign minister. All right, due to weather or whatever, you've got all of these news headlines, and people tend to forget how we got here. Not on the world stage necessarily, but you know, domestically, things like January 6th, things like. Gee, whatever happened to the J6 DNC RNC pipe bomber? And Jack does a great job in really digging down deep into issues. He's got a number, I think 17 books. Well, he's an independent writer and producer. He's written 17 books. I was right. And appeared on C-SPAN's Book TV a dozen times. He's also produced a score of feature-length documentaries. The guy is fabulous, I'm going to tell you. And I'm honored to be able to call him a friend. He serves as a senior editor of Ingram's Magazine and writes regularly for American Thinker. In fact, he's got I think it was to this morning. My days are all kind of munged together. So he's got a couple of really great articles at American Thinker, which I would urge everyone to check out. In fact, I'll put them in the link in the program description box to the Hagman PI. But he writes for American Thinker, American Spectator, World Net Daily, and so on. He's got a PhD from Purdue University, in the event you don't know him, in American Studies, by the way, and a BA in English from Siena College. So he's no slouch. Plus, he's one of the most tenacious, investigative reporters I know. Before I get to Jack, I want to mention this. You know, I always am on the lookout for things that will make my body, my body stronger, my mind sharper. And I was led to Chuck Norris. I'm telling you, Chuck Norris, can you believe he's like 81 years old? Compare that to the potato head in the White House. But have you ever wondered what happened to him? Chuck Norris, that is. I recently saw a video that he made and I was shocked. He's in his 80s and he's still kicking. But he's working out and staying active, and so but still kicking. That's an understatement. What's even more shocking about this? He's stronger. He can work out longer, and even has plenty of energy for his grandkids. He did this by making one change. He says he still feels like he's in his 50s. His wife even started doing this one thing too, and she never felt better. She says she feels 10 years younger, and her body looks leaner, and she's got energy to burn. I'm telling you, that's what I'm looking for. Chuck made a special video that explains everything. So I want you to make sure you watch it by going to chuckdefense.com/Hagman. Seriously, you've got to take a look at this. This is something you really need. Or just click on the link below this video. It's going to change the way you think about your health. Once again, that's chuckdefense.com/Hagman. And click on the link in the description below to watch the video. You're not going to believe how simple this whole thing is. And just a reminder, the legendary Chuck Norris is a whopping, as I said, 81, and yet has more energy than I do. He's discovered he could create dramatic changes to his health simply by focusing on three things. That's right, three. Count them, three. That sabotage our body as we age. Watch his method by clicking in the link in the description box below, chuckdefense.com/Hagman. And I want to thank Chuck Norris, the fine people at behind that as well for supporting this broadcast. So with me, as I said, now again, you know, I've got a 48-hour, 72-hour rule with respect to events. We'll get to what happened with Iran. We'll get to all of the other things. The Donald Trump trial. He could see a verdict this week, and I don't think this is going to happen. Having attended so many and being part of so many trials in my career as an investigator, they're talking, well, what if he takes a stand? You know, that could delay the trial a few more days. I don't think he will. But then, what do I know? Okay, you can never really predict with certainty what happens on trials. And as far as the jury is concerned, 80% voted Biden, 13% not. Maybe it's going to be a mistrial. Maybe it's going to be if anyone says they know how this is going to turn out, I can suspect, but I certainly don't know. So watching that as well. One last announcement, and that is tomorrow, because we're going to be replacing some cabling that's necessary to bring this fine broadcast to you. We are going to be dark tomorrow and back on Wednesday. So just bear in mind. So in that said, pass this program, this episode, around to all of your friends, family members, because, and again, as I introduce Jack again, or bring him on, his new book, which is out, count them, 5 days ago, titled Ashley, The Untold Story of the Women of January 6th. I've got to tell you something. Of all the books that Jack's written, I didn't think he could outdo himself. He has outdone himself with this book. And the nuggets, the information in here, this is a history changer. I'm telling you, this is a game changer for those who are in search of the truth, from Ashley Babbitt to the J6 pipe bombers and so on. So with me, I'm just going to let him loose, Jack Cashel, a good friend of the program, good friend of mine, and just a tremendous man. Jack, how are you?
Yeah, Doug, thanks for having me on. I look forward to getting together again this summer.
Yeah.
I'll be back up that part of the world in about a month.
Okay.
Yeah, this is an interesting project because I started out with the idea that someone should tell the story of Ashley Babbitt. And as I'm sure virtually all your listeners and viewers know, she was shot and killed on January 6th in the U.S. Capitol. And then I thought, well, you know, how can I tell her whole story? There's just so much information we have about her life. And then I thought the way to fill it out would be to tell the story of other women who went to Washington on January 6th as well. And so I end up profiling 10 women, including Ashley Babbitt, including 8 who survived and 2 who did not. Ashley Babbitt, everyone knows. The story of Roseanne Boylan is even more shocking than Ashley's and more covered up. And I get into that in depth. So, but what I was very fortunate is that Ashley's mom agreed to cooperate, Mickey Widhoff. Without that, I wouldn't have pursued the project. And then through the help of one of our mutual friends, Susan Daniels, a private investigator, I was able to get in touch with all 8 of the other women, and they all cooperated. The Boylan family, I was not able to access, partly because there's a political split loyalties in that family, and I think they don't want to fight among themselves. So, but oddly, her story is extremely well documented by, of all people, MSNBC, which chose to dig into her case as a way of exposing QAnon, right? They ended up realizing how deep is the rabbit hole at the Department of Justice. They were stonewalled at every turn. But they did a good job up to the point that they refused to reach the conclusions that were obvious to everyone else who had investigated the case. But just in general, Doug, you know this too. You know this story well. I started thinking I knew January 6th as well as anyone. And I ended up thinking, realizing I didn't know anything when I got into this. I didn't know how, as they say, how deep the rabbit hole went. And it was a really a mind-boggling adventure. And just to clarify, and you're right about one thing, in all the books I've written, I don't make mistakes. I don't get ahead of my skis. I don't say things I can't back up. So if I don't sign on to some grand conspiracy, it's only out of caution. Right. There were conspiracies enough afoot that you don't need to embark on something that's not provable or verifiable.
Exactly. And yeah, I was talking with somebody on, last week, I'm not going to give away too much, who insisted to me, absolutely straight face, insisted that, hey, Ashley Babbitt, actor, still alive, you know. And I just didn't know what to say except here. You've got to read Jack Cashel's book. But, yeah, no, I agree. I agree with 100%. You know, you can't get ahead of your skis. And that's a big thing with investigators and true investigative journalists. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, the sorry about that.
No.
That's my phone going off. I should turn it off. Right. And when you're dealing with the mom of Ashley Babbitt, who I met and have talked to on many occasions, Mickey Witthoft, who's a real warrior on her daughter's behalf, you can't say stuff that isn't true. No. You can't just make stuff up. I mean, you can't, nor can you raise false hopes about what we know and what will happen. But there is enough real knowledge out there that in any kind of fair judicial system would put people in prison. And I'm not just referring to the guy who shot Ashley Babbitt, Michael Byrd. But there's other people involved, and it goes high. It goes deep, and we don't know all of it quite yet. But, you know, you start out with this project thinking, okay, just, you know, kind of a riot, just kind of protest and went wrong. Then you're saying, this is kind of entrapment here, isn't it? It's kind of a setup. And then you really say, at the end of the day, you say, nope, okay, you have to admit it. It was an inside job. You know, there was an inside job quality about it. Where I draw the line, though, is that you're not going to find one great puppet master. Right. There were so many entities involved. They were pulling towards the same ends, and they were often working at odds with each other. That the net outcome was not what anyone really thought it would be. Although the Democrats have been able to milk it for 3 years, it's time for the Republicans to turn the tables, because this is, at the end of the day, the single greatest mass injustice against American citizens since Japanese internment. And if the Republicans don't run on that, they're going to get the Democrats are going to take the issue away from them. The Republicans need to make January 6th their issue, because we've never seen anything like this. I just look at the numbers the other day. What is it? 1,340 arrests, right? You know, 500.
Yeah.
Several people, back there, just communicating with one of them, Jake Lang, who's on prison awaiting trial since day one, right?
Right.
He's still, you know, 3 years and put 3 years in change. So there's a lot to talk about. I'm not sure. Where would you like to begin?
Well, you know, folks, although the book is titled Ashley, The Untold Story of the Women of January 6th, the thing that got me with this, with your work and 264 pages, not a wasted word within the book itself, well-documented, well-founded. There are so many facts that you put forth in your book. This is not just about Ashley Babbitt. This is really about the larger issue and issues surrounding January 6th that really people, I don't care on which side of the aisle you are, if you're intellectually honest, people really need to know this stuff. Because so where do I want to start? Anywhere you think is logical, because again, this is a work that could stand on its own, does stand on its own. And folks, please do this right now. Go to Amazon, and I mean this. Okay, look, I just don't sell any book or I've got to read it and believe in it before I endorse it. And I certainly endorse this. Please go to Amazon.com. Make this a number one bestseller because we need that exposure. So to answer your question, and by the way, the nuggets that you drop in here are really so important for people to get. So conversationally, anywhere you want to go.
Reference back to your original point, and that is the background. I wanted to know, a couple questions I wanted to ask, and one is, why did these women go to Washington on January 6th?
Yeah.
I chose a sample of 10 women. The two I knew I would choose because they died.
Yes.
The other eight was done not randomly, but with, I just wanted to establish a cross-section of ordinary people. Of the eight, just to give you clarification, jumping ahead, the worst any one of the eight was accused of was helping to break a window. And yet six of them have been in prison, and two of them are awaiting sentencing. One of those awaiting sentencing is a great-grandmother from Colorado. And the other one is a New York PD police officer. I'm going to start with a bombshell, okay? Let's start with a bombshell, and then I'll my way back.
All right.
I haven't talked about this public at all. In fact, Doug, this is my first interview. We just talked. Really? You know, I wanted to jump in with you because I knew we could go. We could tell the truth. This is not a story that can be told in 15-minute bites on radio stations.
Right.
I'd much rather do long-form stuff. I'm going to start with a bombshell, and it involves Sarah Carpenter, who is awaiting her sentencing. A lot of these people have been held up by that Fisher versus United States case, which is the obstruction charge, but that's down the road. Sarah Carpenter is a retired NYPD. She spent a month at the site of September 11th, enough so that she was so deranged by the experience she had to retire medically, you know, emotionally she was a wreck. But she's, you know, maintained her life, and you know, she has a child. She's like a lot of these women, they have oddly led uneven lives. They're not like, you know, middle class Johnson County, suburban housewives. So Sarah is a single mom living in New York City, and like a lot of them, she just decided the day before to go, right? So she drives down to Washington, D.C. You know, and she's used to working odd hours as a cop. So she, sleeps in her car when she arrives there. It's about a 4-hour drive from her home in Queens. And then she meets up with some friends who had encouraged her to go. And they, they go to the rally on the Ellipse. And there's a big story there, too. Trump is speaking. She's about ready to go home. And her friends say, oh, no, let's go down to the Capitol, see what's going on. So she goes down to the Capitol and, like most of these women, walks in an open door by the time she gets there. By the time the Trump people get there, everything, all the damage has been done, which is part of the story. She walks in. She has, gets into an odd encounter with the police, but nonviolent, everything. And she gets maced a few times. She comes out, her face is all red, her eyes are watering. And hers was a pretty common experience. Actually, she got a little more roughed up than the average person, although several of the women were severely beaten. We'll get to that, too. And here's the interesting part. Here's the bombshell part. She's driving back to New York on the night of January 6th. And she thinks to herself, I have a friend who lives in Maryland, who lives right off I-95. Maybe I'll just stop by and say hello on the way back, right? So she calls her friend innocently, and her friend says, when her friend learns that Sarah had been at the Capitol, the friend freaks out. Sarah said, I never heard her like this. She was screaming at me, yelling at me. She was yelling, you killed a man. You killed a man. You, meaning you and your crowd, killed someone. And Sarah said, what are you talking about? And the woman says, your people killed a Capitol police officer with a fire extinguisher. You killed him. This is on the evening of January 6th, by the way. This woman's husband was a former U.S. Capitol Police officer, USCP. So Sarah had no reason to doubt that he had gotten the word, right? Now we're talking about 7 o'clock on January 6th. And Sarah was just freaked out. She was so upset that she couldn't even get out of bed the next morning. She was utterly, totally depressed by the thought that she was involved in an incident that killed a police officer. And that with a fire extinguisher, and meanwhile, her friend is putting this, Sarah's doxing Sarah on Facebook. The information's getting all around her neighbor and her friends. Sarah's very Catholic, lives in a parish. Parishioners are, okay, they can maybe deal with the protest, but a murder, you know, that's changed the whole tenor of the reporting on January 6th. This police officer was murdered with a fire extinguisher. That story was known on January 6th, right?
Mm. Yep.
Ryan Sicknick, the officer in question, who was a Trump supporter, by the way, who didn't deserve the blasphemy that was done in his name, dies totally unconnectedly of a stroke on January 7th, right? We see videos of him walking around on the end of the day, January 6th, as though nothing happened, right? He had suffered no trauma, nothing more than any other cop experienced that day, which was relatively, by police standards, always stroll in the park.
Right.
And so what happens on January 6th, on January 7th, someone makes the conscious decision to exploit Sicknick's death and tie him to the rumored murder by fire extinguisher. Someone makes a conscious decision. On January 8th, and I got to give Glenn Greenwald credit for memorializing this on a, he took a still, he took a photo of the New York Times story so it didn't disappear, of the paper copy. Here's what the New York Times reported on the morning of January 8th. Brian Sicknick was killed when a protester bashed him over the head with a fire extinguisher, and he was rushed out of the Capitol with a huge gash, bleeding, on January 6th. That's in there. In the book, I quote it word for word.
Yep.
And this, they cite two law enforcement officials, right?
Okay.
So in other words, two probably high-ranking members of probably the FBI or the Justice Department communicate to the New York Times that a guy, that Brian Sicknick, had been killed on January 6th with a fire extinguisher, when in fact the end of the day walked away just like everyone else did and died of an unrelated stroke the next day.
Let me stop you right there. Was there ever a fire extinguisher to the head of Brian Sicknick? Was that made out of whole cloth?
Totally made out of whole cloth. I saw a video of someone throwing a fire extinguisher, so that probably put the fire extinguisher story in the air. But no one was hurt when it was thrown. You know, it wasn't a good thing for anyone to do, throw a fire extinguisher, but it was without consequence of any, you know, serious consequence.
All right.
And Sicknick was, and we've seen the videos probably, Doug, of Sicknick walking around at the end of the day, just like everyone else.
Right.
Everyone, all the cops got sprayed. Mostly they got sprayed by their own friendly fire, which was reckless and, you know, just amateurish. But he was okay. Now, the autopsy was done on the 8th, right?
Okay.
Or the 7th or 8th. What the medical examiner did, probably with the urging of the people running the show, was to suppress that autopsy report, period. You're supposed to release it within a week. Judicial, 90 days max. After 100 days, Judicial Watch finally forced out the autopsy report. By that time, the story had set in stone. You know what they did with Sicknick, right? They placed his ashes in the memorial of the Rotunda. The person they did that for previously was Ruth Bader Ginsburg, right? That's who is the kind of person it's reserved for, Supreme Court justices. Then they bury him in Arlington. They bury his ashes at Arlington. And so the whole tone of the reporting shifted on a false, not just false, not just a misinformation, disinformation.
Wow.
And Sarah was an interesting link to that. If I hadn't talked to her, I wouldn't have known that detail, that the story was out on the evening of January 6th that a cop had been killed. And then they exploited Sicknick's unexpected death of a stroke, two strokes, on January 7th to take advantage of it. By the way, when the autopsy report comes out, they say it was unrelated. You know, the stroke was organic. You know, it had nothing to do with any external event. And it would have happened if he had been, you know, if January 6th never happened, he would have died of a stroke on January 7th. Then they have him in the rotunda. And then, you know, it starts getting grotesque, because in the next 100 days, for God knows what reason, and no one wanted to investigate why, let's presume that they were all suicides, as suggested, but four Capitol Police officers commit suicide over the course of the next 3 or 4 months. All of those deaths now are then attributed to January 6th. So Merrick Garland, Hakeem Jeffries, all the dignitaries talk about the five police who died as a result of January 6th. And then in court, you know, a lot of the defendants would be sitting there and hearing the judge refer to those five people dead because of January 6th. It's outrageous. And they got away with it. They, to this day, this is the first time this information has been shared publicly, of that conscious decision by someone high up to make Brian Sicknick a martyr.
Okay, that to me really is so important, because I see even today forums, when they reference January 6th, they do hinge a lot on both Sicknick and the fact that the J6 defendants were involved in some way within the court hearing, the deaths of five police officers. And it's just, man, I'll tell you, every time I read that, and it reinforces this falsehood, not even a falsehood, but like you said, there was this deliberate disinformation insinuated into the narrative. And wow, okay, I just, wow, okay. You think you know?
I would argue that the reason they chose to do this is because they did not want the martyr of January 6th to be Ashley Babbitt.
Oh.
You know, the one person who wasn't part of the overarching plan to set this all up was Michael Byrd, right? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's not funny. He was the officer, the Capitol Police lieutenant at that time. He's since been promoted, who shot and killed Ashley Babbitt. It was a total screw-up. I mean, he was cowardly, it was craven, it was reckless. Whether he should be in prison for it, personally, I don't believe in imprisoning cops for making mistakes. But good Lord, if Derek Chauvin could be serving 22 years, Michael Byrd should be, you know, by that standard, he should have been getting a chair. Totally reckless, unjustified shooting. But so at the end of the day, what the media are reporting is that one person was, they couldn't deny that because captured on video.
Right.
The shooting, and what makes it even stranger, Doug, as you know, is that it was captured on video by a Black Lives Matter supporter who just happened to be there, provoking the crowd into rioting, you know, Sullivan, Jake, I think it's Jake Earl Sullivan. Wow. And he immediately, opportunist that he was, I can hardly blame him. He sold the video immediately to CNN. And CNN, in one of its last, you know, sort of vestigial acts of journalism, showed the video on the air. I mean, there's no doubt what happened. That Ashley Babbitt was shot and killed by a police officer. So to compensate for that, to offset that, to change the narrative, the powers that be decided they needed a martyr of their own. And that's how they resurrected poor Brian Sicknick, who didn't deserve what was done to him.
No, I no, it obviously. Obviously. Take a look at this. This is from a House of Representatives special committee. During emotional testimony last week, four police officers told a House of Representatives special committee that they were beaten, threatened, taunted with racial insults, and thought they might die as they struggled to defend the Capitol against the mob. Now, I'm not trying to downplay, you know, the violence part of this. But boy, I'll tell you what, man, that's a loaded quote as far as I'm concerned.
And it's I'm sure it's false.
Yeah.
The notion that they're called racial insults has become the de rigueur fallback, you know, for none of those racial insults were captured on video. I've seen hundreds of hours of videos. You probably watched them too, Doug.
Oh, yeah.
You're not racial insults. I saw one Confederate flag in a crowd, right?
Yeah.
And that made it a white nationalist rally. Yeah. I also saw one rainbow flag, right? And no one suggested there was a gay rights rally. And the 10 women I profiled, and their social media was combed through by the media. Not a racial taunt in the whole bunch of them, right?
Yeah.
I suppose someone somehow might have one somewhere, but there was not. And the whole thing had nothing to do with race. And here they are attributing it to white supremacy, white nationalism. That's nuts. And the people were there. There's lots of minorities there.
Yeah,
a lot of particularly. I don't know particularly why they were there, but there are a fair share of blacks, Asians, a lot of Hispanics. There are Muslims. One woman I profiled was going to profile was a Muslim, but there wasn't just enough. There just wasn't enough information on her, and I didn't believe she'd cooperate. So I moved on.
I mean, the digging you've done in this, if I can stick with Ashley Babbitt for a moment and Michael Byrd, I've watched that clip numerous times. What the hell? I know you can't get in the head of Byrd, but what the hell motivated him to take a shot when clearly, I mean, look,
and part of it is that it refers back to that quote that you just put up there, right?
Uh-huh.
The Democrats, the left in general, had so propagandized themselves into thinking that these people were racist white hordes intent on killing them, that he might have believed that, right?
Oh.
You know, at the time, he was guarding the foyer into the House floor. The House had been cleared, right? Everyone had left except for, it's interesting, the only people left on the House floor were five Republicans. Four were from Texas and one was from Oklahoma. And they were the ones who chose not to flee, but they were guarding the one door, right?
Right.
Main door, and they were communicating with the people on the other side of the door. There was one of the windows was broken, and saying, they're basically saying, cool it, cut this stuff out, you're not doing yourself any good, etc., which was fair to say, right?
Right.
So what happens with Ashley is that she comes up to that, she enters through she enters through a broken window, just to be honest.
Yeah.
She wanders around, she's honoring the rope lines, she's by herself, she's 5'2", 110 pounds. And she gets to the door, the main door, and then she's not one to follow a crowd. She didn't want to be in this crowd. And for the women in particular, a lot of them get caught in these scrums where they lose total control over their direction of their bodies, right?
Yep.
It's you see it at a soccer match or something where people die. So she went by herself, and then she was joined by an independent journalist, a guy named Taylor Hansen. And so she's walking along, and through an empty corridor, she comes to the doors, the barricaded doors, protecting the foyer that leads into the House floor. And again, there's only five people in the House floor, and they're all Republicans at the other door, about 100 feet away. There's no one else in the foyer, which is, I don't know, maybe 50 feet long and 20 feet wide. I don't know. And so there's three police officers guarding those doors. And they're facing Ashley and Taylor, who are the only two people in the hallway at that point. And they joke with him. Taylor gives him some water. And, you know, because Ashley had been a police officer for 14 years in the Air Force, right?
Right.
And she had even been a member of the Washington, the Capitol Guardians, the Washington National Guard, that should have responded to this event hours before they did. And that's another story for another day. So they're there joshing back and forth. And then the hallway begins to fill up. And there's some bad actors in this crowd. One of them is this guy, Sullivan, who is he's been caught on video as a Black Lives Matter supporter and doing, you know, and he's caught on his own video inside the Capitol, urging the protesters to burn the place down, et cetera. He's a clear provocateur. But he's also a videographer. He's got a video camera there. He's shooting it. Also is a guy named Zachary Lamb. And he starts punching. You know, it's getting crowded now. And if you're 5'2" and you're in a big crowded space, it's getting scary, right? And so a Lamb starts punching the windows between the three cops. And Ashley's yelling at him to stop it. And Hansen's yelling at him to cool it, right? And the cops are just standing there doing nothing. So Ashley's getting frustrated, and she's yelling at the cops now, call, and she's using colorful letters, you know, call effing reinforce, call for help, right? Get some help here. Yeah. She's on the side of law and order. She always has been. And she's criticizing their job because this was her job. She knew she could do their job better than they could, right? So this the hallway is now getting crowded up. It's getting dangerously crowded. And from the perspective of someone who's that small.
Right.
And you can see clearly Ashley walks away in frustration for a minute because they're not these guys, three guys are just standing there doing nothing. But then Lamb backs off and he turns, faces the crowd, and he starts holding them off. And then just inexplicably, the three officers walk away from the doors, leaving them unprotected.
Wow.
And then you can see this all. I mean, it takes a while to see to find this all out. Then Lamb grabs a helmet from another protester. Now he really starts, before he had just sort of splintered the glass, now he was actually bashed out a whole window, a whole transom, a whole panel of a door. And now it's getting a little tense in there. The three officers walk away off to the side. There's a tactical unit coming up the stairs, but instead of handing them off, handing that door off to the tactical officers, they're still stuck on the stairs, you know, minutes away. There's a sergeant-at-arms officer there who's doing nothing. And Ashley's yelling at them, do your effing job, right?
Right.
It's not happening. And then we hear the shout of gun. See, he's got a gun, right? And we see some of the protesters see Michael Byrd's gun being extended on the far side of the barricaded doors. Ashley doesn't see the gun, but she hears them yelling, there's a gun, it's a gun. She doesn't know where the gun is, right?
That's true.
And at that moment, yeah, you have a good image of the gun here. It's at that image, she jumps into the broken out panel. And Byrd here doesn't even know if she's a woman. There's no one back here other than a couple other cops, right? And then he just shoots and kills her, one shot.
Man, that's an execution as opposed to, I mean, I don't know how else to describe that, but go ahead.
No, I mean, you're exactly right. It's like, had this happened in the streets of Minneapolis, this cop would have been in prison for the rest of his life. We could be sure of that. Instead, he was cleared by the DOJ, the U.S. Capitol Police, FBI, et cetera. And Ashley Babbitt falls backwards into the room. She's tended to by a doctor who's a protester there. And then the police pull the doctor off. And basically, she's allowed to bleed out, you know, before they could bring help in. And dies. She dies, I think, formally at the hospital a half hour later. But she's essentially killed right there. And Most of the other people don't even know this is going on. But it wasn't part of the plan. That's the weird thing, is that Byrd really screwed their plans up. He forced them to the conspirators to change the narrative, to finesse, to improvise, because it wasn't happening. On the outside, by the way, and this is really spooky, minutes after Ashley is shot, there's a puff of smoke that goes up. You may have seen these videos. Before I get there, one more note about what happened inside. Before Ashley jumps in, a lamb is smashing out the glass with the helmet. She grabs his backpack with her right hand, and she's a southpaw. And she pulls him face around, and she punches him in the face with her left hand, knocking his glasses off, right? That's all captured. That's when it's that moment that she jumps in up and says, you know, I'm out of here. I'm not going to deal with this. Whether she's afraid of getting shot, crushed, or just she knew there were bad actors now in that room with her. By the way, Alam had a series of arrests before, had no social media history tying him to Donald Trump or MAGA. And then he gets shot. So a puff of smoke goes up outside where the protesters are milling around in front of the west side of the Capitol. And at that moment, you see, I got to give credit to Nick Searcy here in his new a movie, War on Truth, because I just saw it there. Ray Epps, who's been the leading provocateur here, turns around with four guys in front of him, four guys behind him, and vacates the Capitol. So something happened there that wasn't supposed to happen, and that caused a change in plans, and that, I think, set in motion the martyrdom of Brian Sicknick.
Please, I hope you followed that well-stated course of events, including and especially the fact that Byrd probably screwed up, well, not probably, ultimately by his decision to execute Ashley Babbitt, changed or necessitated a change of tactics and such with the narrative. But you know what, Jack, your book goes so far into various, I mean, we could spend, and I think before airtime, we could spend like shows, days, pretty much on each chapter, each individual, each event that you really investigated, because there's much more to this than people realize. And you connect some major dots. You lay out the information where major dots can be connected. So, okay. So that's kind of a big view of the Babbitt scenario. Is there anything more about Ashley Babbitt, her mom, whatever, that for this broadcast you would like to mention?
Yeah, just a couple things. A major part of my book is explaining the motives. I began with the question of why did these women go to Washington, and I walked away thinking, why did the rest of us not go to Washington? Why did the rest of us stay home? Right?
There you go.
I mean, they went for the right reasons. They went to protest what was only, at this point, a corporate toady would say was a fair and just election, you know?
Right.
And if they didn't protest, who would? Right? Because the corporate media had been bought off. You couldn't say the election was rigged on Fox News even, right? You had to be very careful what you said. And I understand that frustration. We were all frustrated. These people had more gumption than we did. That's it. So she, just in another, in a way of background too, of all the reasons that Ashley Babbitt might have jumped through that window pane, the one reason that she did not jump through was to lead an insurrection. You know, it was the opposite. She was trying to suppress a riot, as she had been trained to do. And she clearly needed to escape that space. And it's hard to blame her, because some of the women who got the other, let's just talk about the other woman who got killed briefly, okay. Roseanne Boylan. Again, you're in a crowd, and this becomes evident if you ever watch these English soccer footage, like where people get caught in crowds.
Yep.
They have no more control over where they're going, especially if they're small. It's easy for them to get, you know, suffocated or to get trampled, whatever. And that's what happened to Roseanne Boylan, who oddly died almost 2 hours later after Ashley did, when she got caught in a crowd and couldn't control the movement of that crowd. And here's the weird thing about Roseanne's death. I just want to talk a little more about Ashley, though, but just want
sure,
to
sure.
Picture, is that when you look at the videos of what happened on January 6th, the people were inside the Capitol by 2 o'clock, and Ashley was killed about 2:45. At least a half a dozen doors were wide open. Most people just walked in, right? The police there were acting like they were ushers at a regular Wednesday afternoon, and were just showing people around.
Yep.
They were having pleasant exchanges. The protesters were walking in between the rope lines, right? That's 9/10 of the experience. But for no reason I could quite understand, other than made for good, easy visuals, the tunnel entrance on the west side of the Capitol, the police protected like it was the Alamo. And that battle there went on for 2 hours. That's where Roseanne Boylan was killed. That's where several other people were beaten. It makes no sense.
Hmm.
Yeah, but, you know, that's a story. When we will talk about Roseanne perhaps some other time, Doug, because that's the Roseanne story is more shocking than the Ashley story.
Well, in terms that's of hard to, unless folks, you grab a hold of a copy of Jack's book, which I highly recommend you do. Go to Amazon.com. And in fact, the link will be in the program description box, the Hagman PI. But you will be educated, shocked, infuriated. The range of emotions of Jack Cashel's findings. The book is, of course, Ashley, The Untold Story of the Women of January 6th. You can get it in hardcover, paperback at the moment. And I'll tell you what, it's worth every penny, worth the read. I would urge everyone who follows this broadcast and who really want to know the truth, get it today, order it today, and let's make this number one. Because again, the nuggets that are in here are just phenomenal. But go ahead, Jack.
Let me just give a little more background on Ashley. Now, she had served 14 years in the Air Force in one capacity or another, either on reserve or on active duty. She'd made, I think, at least 8 overseas deployments to every kind of shithole country you can think of, you know, including Afghanistan and Iraq. And she was essentially a military police in one form or another. And after she was married, divorced early, her mother, Mickey Widhoff, loves both of her son-in-laws. It was kind of amicable. They were both young when they got married. Immediately after Ashley died, the New York Times and other media set out to go after her, right? To find out any flaws in her background and expose them, et cetera, which they did. And she didn't lead, as her mother said, she was not a perfect person, but she was an amazing woman. And that's pretty much the case. She and her husband, Aaron Babbitt, after they met on the East Coast and moved back to San Diego, where her family's from. And Mickey was thrilled to have him back there. They opened a pool supply business. And here's an interesting detail that I did not expect to find. I said, what were the common bond of all 10 of these women? Actually, only 9 of them. I do not know this about Roseanne, but I do know this about the other 9 women. Every one of them, Ashley, most notably, perhaps, was a COVID dissident, right? Several of them were totally radicalized by the government lockdowns and the mask requirements. This was even before the vaccine. And they were anticipating that, and they were dead set against that. It's amazing. I didn't expect to find this. So Ashley had a sign on her door. It said, masks not required in here. This is America. Something like that, you know. And another sign on our door said, if you believe in wearing a mask when you're outside, I don't think there's anything we could do to help you. You know. So,
well, and then, wow. 9 of the 10 verifiable.
Yeah. Okay. And 9 of the 10 drove to Washington because they refused to abide by airplane restrictions.
Amen. And, okay.
I mean, some of them drove from New York. Oh, that's 4 hours. Or Atlanta, that's 10 hours. But Boise, Idaho, that's 35 hours, right?
Yeah.
Rebecca Lavrenz, who's I've gotten to know pretty well because I went to her trial. This is a great-grandmother from Colorado. Okay. Drove 25 hours by herself, right?
Oh.
And Ashley, so Ashley had to fly. She come from San Diego. Her husband, Aaron, had to stay behind because someone had to run the pool business, you know, their business.
Right.
They had just got off vacation in Cabo. And so, but Ashley gets on a plane with her Trump 2020 mask on. You know? And, you know, she's not, okay, she's not going to hide her destination or her, you know, her affections, right? And that's the kind of person she was, independent, fearless. The FBI, this is also appalling, opened an investigation on her the day after she died, right?
Wow.
To try to dig up dirt on her past. The job was to sully her reputation before she had a chance to build one. They did not want a martyr. They wanted their person to be the martyr.
And to be clear, this is actually Trump's Department of Justice, right?
This is allegedly Trump's FBI, but the FBI was, you know, not working. They were working against Trump's best interests at the time.
Okay. Yeah. Glad you made that clarification. Okay.
Right, because in the run-up to the election, the FBI was suppressing. This is the same intelligence community that suppressed Hunter Biden's laptop. You know, I mean,
that's right.
If you wanted a rigging, and that really set anyone who was undecided that the election was about to be rigged, when 51 intelligence officials conspire to claim that a laptop that the FBI had in its possession for a year was a Russian plant, right? The people who were paying attention were the ones who showed up in Washington. The people who were complacent and didn't care much, or, you know, just read the CNN or whatever, they didn't even know what was going on around them. And that's the same was true. I mean, the people who followed the COVID rules were, you know, there's a fascinating poll that came out. I don't want to go too much into COVID now, but in the Gallup did a poll in the second half of 2020. So we're at least 6 months, 8 months, 9 months into constant media about COVID, right? So the people who are well informed, or the people who are watching CNN, other news, those of us who are following it on social media, we're disinformed. We didn't know anything. We were eating worse than warmer and all that stuff. But so they did this poll, 35,000 Americans. And they asked a question, among other questions, the most tangible one was, what percent of the people who contact COVID end up in a hospital, right?
Okay.
41% of Democrats said 50% or more. So you follow me?
So
40% of Democrats said that if you get COVID, there's a 50% chance or more or likelihood that you'll end up in a hospital. Another 28 Democrats said 20 to 50%. The right answer as to what percent of the people who get COVID end up in a hospital? And the answer was known at the time, wasn't, you know, like a flexible answer, was 1 to 5%. So 41% of Democrats were grotesquely misinformed by their own media about the dangers of COVID. Another 28% were seriously misinformed. So 69% of Democrats were just absurdly misinformed about a subject that had been in the news every day, every hour of every day for the last 6, 8, 9 months. Meanwhile, the Republicans were 3 times more likely to get the right answer. If this is what they knew about COVID, this cohort of people was no more enlightened than what they knew about January 6th or what they knew about Hunter Biden's laptop or what they knew about vote harvesting or granny farming or what they knew about the unconstitutional changing of state laws to accommodate, COVID, right? But the people who went to January 6th, who went to Washington on January 6th, knew. And that's what made them different from the rest of Americans. And that's what made them vulnerable to the predations of what would be become the very shortly the Biden DOJ.
Man, that is, I guess that could be another, well, a different but very closely related rabbit hole. And again, folks, you're listening to Jack Cashel, the author of his newest book, Ashley, The Untold Story of the Women of January 6th, available at Amazon. I would quickly put this in your cart. I mean, absolutely, and buy it, because, folks, the information in here will open your eyes. You think you know, like I thought I knew, but there are nuggets in here. There's information in here, facts that will blow you away. And yes, I absolutely am endorsing and hawking this book, because I believe in the historical significance of this book. And you always come through, by the way, with these things that whether you're writing about TWA 800 or something else, there's always more to the story that you bring out. That's just fabulous. In the remaining moments that we have with you, any other bombshells I can keep you here for a couple of days just talking like this. But what, any other things we should focus on or that you would like to point out?
I would say, and let me just tease with this, because it will take some time to get into. I'd love to come back next week or whenever, Doug. And happy to stop in next month when I get to.
Oh, you have an open invitation, brother.
Get to your part of the world. But I think one thing that has been overlooked by everyone, you know, we talk about the FBI and DOJ and Capitol Police. The one thing that we overlook is the role of the D.C. Medical Examiner's Office, right?
Ooh.
And I stumbled onto this because I've been following the only people less popular in America's newsroom than the J6ers, which is Derek Chauvin and his fellow officers. Let me just tease with this, and we can come back and pick it up. And the Derek Chauvin case, and that took place in May 2020. So the whole of January 6th protesters had watched for 9 months, 8 months, America be burned down by protesters who were considered heroes, right?
Right.
Whose fines usually were usually discharged altogether again, you know, $30 fine or something. But the reason they were able to convict Derek Chauvin, and this, let me take a 5-minute setup if I can. The medical examiner in Hennepin County, where Minneapolis is, was a guy named Andrew Baker. He does the exam on George Floyd the day after his death. He comes back and he tells the prosecutors, "You're not going to like what I'm going to tell you. He did not die of a strangulation or asphyxiation. He died likely of severe heart disease, I'm sort of aggravated by not so much his fentanyl use, but his methamphetamine use, which is an accelerant. I mean, triggers that stuff." And he said there is no signs of neck injury at all, right?
Right.
So they were a little upset about this, because the narrative had already been set that Chauvin had strangled this guy to death, right? Put his neck and, you know, a knee on his neck. And so then a couple days later, once the word or the preliminary report leaks out, but not officially, Baker gets a call from the medical examiner of the District of Columbia, a black activist named Roger Mitchell. And Mitchell discusses his findings with Baker. And Baker says, "You don't want to be the only person in the room who gets this wrong, you know that." And then Mitchell thinks about it over the weekend. And then he comes back and he says to Baker, "If you go forward with this original finding, I'm going to write an op-ed in the Washington Post and blacken your name," right?
Yeah.
Now, Mitchell,
Hold that thought. Folks listening to this on Global Star, flip over to Rumble and also any of the audio podcast platforms for continuing, because we're going to lose Global Star. And continue, please, Jack.
So anyhow...